Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Elizabeth Carney. I'm the chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled How Wall Street is Fleecing You and Ruining America. You can find our website at commonwealthclub.org. We invite our audience to visit us there to learn about many of the fine programs that are held here at the club. It also contains an archive of past programs in case you missed something and want to listen to it again. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Leland Faust. He is in conversation tonight with Roy Eisenstadt. Leland Faust is an honors graduate from UC Berkeley in economics and Harvard Law School. He founded CS Capital Management in 1978 and managed over $1.5 billion in assets. He has represented over 100 NFL, NBA, MLA, MLB All-Stars. He has been profiled in the New York Times, Barron's, Sporting News, the San Francisco Chronicle, the San Francisco Examiner, Sports Illustrated, the Wall Street Journal, and many others. He's appeared on major networks and financial cable networks. Here he is in conversation with Roy Eisenhart, former president of the Oakland Athletics. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, welcome, Leland. Our main purpose tonight is to cheer everybody up. Secondarily, we will discuss Leland's new book, and hopefully they will work in synchronicity. However, actually, it's funny, I was interviewing an author recently who said, you know, the best sign that the interviewer hasn't read my book is when they ask me about the title. So I'm going to have to somehow get past that inference, Leland, because I think in the rest of our evening, framing the title of your book, I think, is very important. A capitalist lament is one phrase, very poetic, but the How Wall Street is Ruining basically ruining America. I'll summarize it at that, is where I'd like to start. I'd like you to say why you chose that as your title.
Well, thank you, Roy. Well, I started with a capitalist lament because I wanted to make sure that my readers understood that I am very devoted to the free enterprise system and that I believe without free enterprise, we're all going to be poorer and we're all going to have much less freedom. So it's a capitalist lament. It's someone who believes in this system that we have and that I don't want to do away with the system. I want to help fix it. And I think that Wall Street main firms have hijacked the system for their own selfish benefit so that they can, you know, make more money and the things that come with that, have more power and control over things. So I think that's, for me, an important starting point. When we go to the sort of the subtitle of how Wall Street is fleecing you, we'll stop with that one first. Yeah. Again, I don't believe either part of that subtitle is a hyperbole. The mainstream Wall Street, unfortunately, is not on your side. They're out for themselves. They're out to maximize their own income at their investors' expense. Now, being a capitalist, I think it's okay to make money and profit, but not if you're taking advantage of the system because you can and you can get away with it. The capitalist system has a couple of characteristics. It first of all, it implies an educated market, that there's knowledge on both sides. Well, that's not the case here. There's unequal knowledge in many, many cases. Another very important factor is that the parties that invest or put their money at risk are bearing the loss potential, that with a gain comes a possibility of a loss. If we divorce those two things, then the system breaks down and we get a lot of the behaviors that we see today. And I think that's been too prevalent. Now, as to the last part about ruining America, again, not an exaggeration. If we look at how this plays out, well, some of the things I think are more apparent than others. But for instance, if because of Wall Street we have massive bailouts, well, that has a real impact. The government then is spending money on bailing out the companies, and even if they get a lot of it back later, they've still spent $800 billion doing that. So therefore, other programs that might have been financed weren't. If Wall Street has pension plans paying too much, then that has a big impact. Either the pensioners are going to get less, or the government, if they're government pension plans, is going to have to pay more to do that. So taxes are going to go up. So this has an impact. Or at the extreme, if you have funds, you know, going under, then it's really a problem. If you have a situation where Wall Street's encouraging get-rich-quick schemes, and we destroy the incentives for hard work and slow and steady, then again, I think that has a real impact on the society. So there are lots of others, but I think those are some of the major ones.
And I want to say at the outset, we're not going to be able to cover near one-tenth of the amount of material that's in this book. I highly encourage you to read it. It's a very educational as well as informational about the problems that Leland's addressing. Let's dig into it a little bit, but I'm always puzzled by what we mean by the term Wall Street. I mean, I know there's a street called Wall Street, but what is the market segment that you're describing as, quote, Wall Street?
Well, to some degree, different people would have different answers to that question. When I'm using the term Wall Street, I'm using the major firms that have huge financial interests in America. So I'm talking about the major banks in America. I'm talking about the major stock brokerage firms, the major insurance companies, the rating services that service these companies, some of the mutual fund complexes, the government to some degree, because the government regulates this and the Congress passes laws that affect it. So even though that's not technically Wall Street, to put it in quotes, it's really part of the problem. So it's really the sort of the very large, well-established firms that are leading the financial world. That's what I'm referring to as Wall Street.
Yeah, I thought it would be good to get that out because we have a lot of other elements of the financial market who are not engaging in a lot of the behaviors that you talk about in this book. Let's go to example. Somebody calls me and says, hey, I got this really good buy I can put you into on some Class C mutual fund shares. And the Class C is really good because blah, blah, blah. And they give me this sales pitch, and it sounds to me like I'm getting quite a good deal. I'm taking this example from your book, obviously.
Yes.
Why don't you explain that and as a typical example, I think, of what you're talking about the lack of fiduciary accountability that the investment advisor has to his client.
Sure. Well, in the example that I use in the book that you're referring to, it's in the part of the book which I call the triumph of selfish interest that the Wall Street firms are engaged in. Self-interest is great, but selfish interest isn't. Well, Wall Street, many of the main firms in Wall Street started the mutual fund industry long ago, and they were salesmen, and they got commissions for putting their clients into it. So you would invest $1,000, but 5% would go for a commission, so $950 would actually go to work for you. Well, over time, it became clear with the proverbial every academic study that the firms that charged these commissions didn't perform better than the firms and the mutual funds that didn't charge commissions. That, and you say, well, how do people get paid if they don't get commissions? Well, they got paid management fees for managing the fund every year, but they didn't pay salesmen. So Wall Street was taking a lot of heat that how can you sell these commission products, so-called load products, when the no-load funds are performing better? And so they had to come up with a solution. So they came up with this brilliant marketing plan. And they created the Class C shares. Well, the Class A shares were the ones that had the commission, the 5% or so commission. The Class B shares had a commission if you got out before a certain amount of time. But there was that. The Class C shares they came up with, and the sales pitch went something like this. Well, we had Class A shares and Class B shares that do have commissions, but we're going to have a new Class C share that won't have a commission going in or going out as long as you agree to stay for at least 5 years. And by the way, that's a good idea. You want to be a long-term investor with your mutual fund shares, and you don't want to be paying in and out costs. So great. So sign up and stay for 5 years, no commission. But you have to keep your word. If you go out early, then the first year you got to pay us the 5% commission. The second year, 4%. Third year, 3%, etc. But at the end of 5, no commission. So the sales of the A shares essentially went to zero. And the C shares started getting all the business from the companies. Well, what they didn't tell you in the sales pitch, and it was disclosed in the legal documents, kind of the proverbial buried on page 100 of the fine print, was that the C shares carry an extra 0.75% per year in management fees. So that no matter when you get out, you pay more by using the C shares. If you stay for 2 years, you pay a 4% exit fee, and 2 years at 0.75% or 1.5%, so you paid 5.5%. You stay for 10 years, you're a really good long-term investor, you paid 7.5% instead of the 5. So this is an example of the sort of the pigs feeding at the trough and not doing what they should be by their clients.
It's basically a matter of not disclosing the management fee if you come right down to it, right?
Well, actually, yeah, absolutely, that's what it is. But this is not an exact number, but my guesstimate is that over the years between clients, prospective clients, small conversations, I've told this to 100 people. And one of those 100 people knew what was really happening before I told them. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's a deep little secret that they've gotten away with and illustrative of the problem.
So I'm a company, private company, and I'm positioned well with earnings and good prospects, so I want to go public. And so I go to a firm, agrees to underwrite my offering, and we'll call it an IPO or initial public offering. And so we go out into the market at, these are hypothetical numbers, $40. 3 days later, the shares are selling at $80. As a company, did I get a good deal, or did I get a bad deal, or something in between? Why is the stock worth $80 3 days later, when I only got $40 of capital per share in the IPO?
Well, what you've just described has sort of been the too often the standard since the mid-90s and into the dot-com era of the late 90s until it exploded in 2000. In the, you know, the good old days, the companies worked with their investment bankers to figure out how much they could sell the stock for, the maximum they could get for the number of shares they were going to be selling, which would mean then they would get that money to use in the business.
Mm-hmm.
Well, later on, they started to notice a couple of potential things that they could do. One, some of the companies wanted to use the IPO as a way to attract attention. And so what better way to attract attention than to have shares come out at, your example, you know, $40 a share and immediately jump so that, oh, my God, this is a really hot stock. It's really valuable. Right. I got to get in. So they started using it as a way to attract attention and sort of literally they used the term branding for, mm-hmm. for what they were doing. But what they were essentially doing, and if it's still doing it, it happens today, is transferring money from the company, which was going public. If the stock could really clear a market at $80 a share, then half the money went to the company,
right.
and half the money went to the lucky first investors who were able to get it at the IPO.
And how did they become the first investors?
They became the first investors by being favored customers.
Yeah.
So if you were a big player, had a big account generating lots of commissions, you could get an allocation. If you were a mutual fund and were trading with them, you could get an allocation. So it was a way to curry business, too, because you'd go to a mutual fund and you say, okay, you know, I'll sell you these shares at IPO, but I want you doing your business with me in the now and in the future. And then they would do that. The mutual fund would make money on the IPO, which would make its return, by the way, look better than it really was in terms of their track record, because they were just getting fed, you know, profit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was depriving the company of money, which it otherwise could have had. So it was really a bad deal for the company. And one of the interesting cases in the last, you know, few years that did not go that way was Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Facebook, and then it didn't have this big pop the first day, and it got criticized for doing the right thing. Well, the good news for Facebook is it's gone up many times
yeah.
since the IPO, whereas some of these companies that jumped from 40 to 80 never saw 80 again,
right.
and the investors who weren't the favored investors who got the IPO shares really got hurt. And so that's been a big problem too, hurting the small guy to help the big guy.
Mm-hmm.
And with these hot IPOs, in more cases than not, that's what happens.
But the company is essentially giving away a lot of its market value by permitting an IPO to go out undervalued.
That's right. And they've done that because they think the other elements, some of which I talked about already, are worth it. Or they think that if they can get a feeding frenzy and the rest of their stock will ultimately be worth more, even though they're not selling it that day. If you can get a company that, because of a hot IPO, is selling at 40 times earnings, and that's better for them than if it's selling at 30 times earnings in a more realistic figure because they own still most of the stock.
But if you were a shareholder in that company before the IPO and it goes out undervalued, your interest has been diluted.
That's correct, yes. Yeah, so it dilutes your interest as a shareholder,
yeah.
and it certainly deprives. And sometimes these companies have run out of money, and they could have had more if they just had had a more reasonably priced yeah. IPO. Again, slow and steady versus trying to get rich quick.
So my same friendly broker calls me and says he's got a couple of hedge fund opportunities for me, and I really shouldn't stay out of them because anybody with half a brain is grabbing these things.
Well, hedge funds are a very interesting phenomena. The idea of a hedge fund, you know, way back when and why the term comes from, actually started out as a decent idea that was perverted by Wall Street very quickly. The idea was that a fund would hedge the investments by doing things which wouldn't necessarily move at the same direction at the same time. So a fund might own certain stocks that would go up under certain circumstances and certain stocks would go up under others. So they were kind of hedging your bets and being more balanced. Or they would try to own things that weren't necessarily correlated with one another historically. So they might own some things that would go up during inflationary times and some things that would go up if prices were more stable. So they were hedging it. Well, pretty soon the whole thing changed, and the reason that it changed was hedge funds were able to have their fee structures set as if they were private equity venture capital firms instead of stocks and bonds. Now, the difference was that in the private world, many times the promoters of the deals were able to negotiate where they would get 20% of the profits if there were later profits on the sale of an asset. So if you bought an apartment building and you held it for 5 years and then it went up, $150,000, the person who put it together after his investors got all the money back and maybe a profit on top of that would then get 20% of the difference, or in my example, could make $30,000. Mm-hmm. But then some bright person, I said, well, let's apply this to hedge funds, even though we're just investing in stocks and bonds.
Yeah.
Well, it changed the whole thing so that if you called yourself an investment manager, you might make a 1% fee or less, whereas if you called yourself a hedge fund manager, you'd make a 2% fee plus 20% of the profits for doing the same thing. There was a professor at the University of Chicago Business School who says to this day, and I agree with him, a hedge fund is a way to charge more money disguised as a class of assets. And that's what's happened. And so the hedge funds today are not doing that. They're just an excuse for charging more for the same thing, or even worse, charging more for gambling. And they do things which they say are to hedge, but in fact they're just to gamble. So they involve themselves in options, in short sales, in derivatives, things. These are the technical terms for them. We can define them if you want me to. But the idea is they're actually engaging in gambling transactions, and the reason is they want to exploit that 20% profit. They want to take a chance, because if they take a chance and win, they get their 20%. If they take a chance and lose, it's somebody else's money, yeah. Which gets us back to another problem I talked about before. Capitalism doesn't work if you're taking chances with other people's money unless you are a true fiduciary, meaning that you're really acting as if it were your own, but most of them don't.
Yeah.
So, therefore, what happens? They take a chance, it goes up, they get their 20%. They take a chance, they lose, it goes down. Somebody else loses, they go out of business with that fund and start a new one so they can start all over and try to convince other people to come with them again. So these hedge funds have become a way to gamble. Most of them are very risky. Clearly, over time, the hedge funds have grossly underperformed the S&P 500 index. There's no 10-year period that I've seen where they're even close. The only 5-year period when they're even close was the 1 year in 08 when the markets crashed. And in some 5-year periods, which include 08, the hedge funds eked out a teeny victory. But the next 5 years, the average hedge fund trailed the S&P 500 by, I believe it was 14% per year. So if they outperformed for 1% for the one worst year in 75 and then underperformed by 14% a year for the next five, I think that tells you what's going on. So the hedge funds are just a way that Wall Street and its establishment have been able to get their hands on $3 trillion worth of assets just to be able to charge more for poor performance. And it's just an example of a combination of what I've referred to in the book as a selfish interest, and also it's a big part of what I, again, referred to in the book as the ultimate con job, which is getting people thinking they're investing and, in fact, they're gambling.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, because Darwin would tell us that these hedge funds would have gone to some point near extinction at this point if the returns are as you describe. So there's a psychological element that keeps this market driven and growing?
Well, yes, I think there's certainly that's the case that, you know, they constantly sell it on the basis of, you know, we're going to do better next time, or one of the things which is a major problem, I guess, across all Wall Street, is always pretending that when you manage something and it didn't go well, it was somebody else's fault, not mm-hmm. yours. Totally unforeseen. You know, if only we hadn't had the crash in 2008, everything would have just been fine. Well, we did have the crash, mm-hmm. and my money suffered because you did. We did have the crash, and the fact that you can say, "Well, it wasn't predicted." So what? You know, it wasn't predicted. Or, you know, if only interest rates hadn't gone down, we'd have been fine. Or only if inflation had been lower. Who could have predicted the Gulf War? Or who could have predicted, you know, Saddam Hussein and the second Gulf War. Yeah. Well, guess what? We live in the real world, and these things count. And so that's a lot of how they get away with it. I mean, some of them, and I know this is hard to believe, but they advertise, and they've said, well, our models worked. It was the markets that didn't work. And they get away with it. You know, they're brilliant academic models. And so it's that. There's also this delusion, and it's across Wall Street, it's across a lot of other things too, that we can pick the good ones. And I literally had that discussion with the person who runs a retirement fund for the state, the city of San Francisco. And I suggested to them, as they were starting to go into hedge funds, I said, this is a terrible idea. Don't do it. And I sent all the board members the facts that, you know, showed that hedge funds underperform, and they came back to me and they said, we can't argue with your statistics, but we can pick the good ones. And I said, do you understand what kind of money you could make in the financial world if you could pick good hedge funds?
Yeah.
I mean, I said, I don't care what you're paid. No. Start with an extra zero or two.
Yeah. Well, and there is a liquidity or illiquidity aspect to them as well. You can't just get your money out whenever you wish. What do you think? I mean, CalPERS, what is CalPERS doing about this?
Well, CalPERS, on the issue of the hedge funds, came to their senses and said that they were going to get out completely, and they've been in the process of doing that. So they're out substantially. Some, they're still struggling with the point that you just mentioned, Roy, that some of these hedge funds have long lead times that you have to give in order to get out, which again is sold on the basis of, well, we need to have this lead time so we can strategically liquidate our investments if investors get out. In fact, it's just a way to keep you in longer and earn the fees longer, which is a major motivation for that. You could have them much quicker if that was the only reason. Mm-hmm. So CalPERS has got out at a time when the San Francisco Pension Fund said they were getting in, despite being told it wasn't a very good idea.
Yeah. You mentioned derivatives and I don't know if you said CDOs or not before, but it would be worth talking about that, because it's one thing to buy equity or share in an underlying company. It's an intangible piece of paper that represents a percentage of ownership in an actual company. But when we start inventing what we'll call derivatives and then backing those up with credit default swaps and the other, what I'll call secondary or less tangible investment vehicles, it strikes me that starts to get really close to gambling. So what I'd ask you to do is to comment about this market that has been created by these quite clever people about how to turn, you know, lemonade into lemons rather than the other way around.
I hadn't thought of that before, but that's good. I like it. Well, the idea of of a derivative. First, let's sort of have a general definition of what it is. A derivative, well, let me back up a second. An investment, you buy something. Now, it is represented by pieces of paper, yes, but those pieces of paper represent an ownership of an asset. So if you own stock in a company, you just say you own a small piece of everything the company owns. So you actually own something. You own something that is hopefully generating income and profits. It has assets. If you buy a bond, you have a claim for $1,000 typically. So you loan your money out, you get a bond back that says you get your money back with interest. Okay. You own a piece of real estate, you actually own something where you actually touch. Okay. Now, a derivative is something which is only a contract between two parties which derives its value, hence its name, from something else. So if I own a derivative, I may be just making a bet with you. You think that the price of a stock is going to go down. I think it's going to go up. So that's what a short sale is. You say it's going to go down. I'm selling it short. I say it's going to go up. Whatever you make, I lose exactly the same amount, or vice versa. It's a closed system. And that's why I believe it's gambling, because whatever, and in Wall Street, it's a negative system, because whatever I make, you lose, and their commissions. So the two of us together, guaranteed to lose. Whereas with real investments, we can both get what we want. I can own a stock, I can make money, I can sell it to you, you can buy it, it can still go up because it's a good company. We can both own something rather than just a bet against one another. So what Wall Street was finding as time was going on, is that there was a finite number of stocks and bonds, and they can only sell so many of them. But they can sell as many derivatives as they can find customers who want to buy them. And the more they can trade them, the more they can sell. So, for instance, there was a company called Delphi. It was a big auto parts maker. And it had about $2 billion worth of bonds outstanding at the time it filed for bankruptcy. But it turned out that it had $10 billion of derivatives based on those same bonds. So they could only sell $2 billion of bonds, but they sold $10 billion worth of derivatives on those same bonds. So that's kind of the way that they can, increase their revenue by having these bets of you against me. Mm-hmm. Even though we didn't necessarily own Delphi bonds at all.
Yeah.
And I will say that the movie The Big Short had this very good sort of illustration of how these derivatives work and how they're gambling. Well, they started out with somebody playing roulette. Well, and that was in their movie, the actual investor. So the actual investor is playing roulette. Okay, but then somebody's standing over his shoulder kibitzing, and it's like he's playing roulette, and then you and I make a bet on whether he's going to win.
Right.
So that's the first derivative.
Yeah.
And then somebody watching us makes a bet on whether I'm going to win my bet with you.
Right.
So now we have a second level derivative. And that's kind of really what's going on and why it needs to be stopped.
But then bring the insurance issue into it, where everybody can buy insurance on the possibility that you might win or lose, and so the AIGs of the world end up insuring, like an example of you use
right.
in the book of the house burning down.
Right. Well, when I insure, if I insure my house, if I own my house, I can do one of two things. I can just say if it burns down with a fire, if I don't have a mortgage, I can do that, right? Okay, or I can insure it against a fire. Fine. All right, but Roy can't go out and buy an insurance policy against my house, because then he's just gambling that my house is going to burn down. So that's an example of a...
In fact, it gives me incentive to burn your
house
right.
down. That's right. So that's the example of a credit default swap. So an example would be, using a real example would be, if you own a General Electric bond, and you say, okay, General Electric's supposed to pay me. Well, then I go out and I say, okay, I'm going to going to get involved in the credit default swap. If General Electric defaults on its bond, then you're going to pay me whatever they don't. So I've insured my bond. Again, that's fine. But back to my example with Delphi. If there were five times the number of bonds and there were, pardon me, derivatives and there were bonds, and it's like five neighbors insuring my house. And that's what's that's what's been going on.
And if it burns down, all five of us get paid the value of your house.
That's right. But if AIG is the insurer and they're leveraged and then they can't make good on that contract, then the government has to, quote, has to bail them out, and then we have the mess that we had.
Mm-hmm. And that's why you should watch The Big Short. We are, for those who are either listening to this on the radio or watching it on C-SPAN, recognize that we are less than 24 hours since the presidential election. So I'm going to ask you to put on your kind of prognosticator hat and give you the allowance that none of us know really what's going to happen. But if you were to take a look at Wall Street as it's configured now, including what's good about it and what's bad about it, how do you see the new administration coming in affecting the environment that you've been talking about?
Well, first, I'm happy you didn't ask me to predict what the markets would do, because
that's... No, not what the markets are
going to
do.
I'm happy you didn't ask me that.
Well, you shorted the Dow, I assume.
Oh, that's right. Yes. First thing yesterday.
Yeah.
Well, I think there are a number of things that I see here. Part of it is going to obviously depend upon who Donald Trump chooses as his advisors. Mm-hmm. I am not sitting here today feeling very good about that personally, and precisely because one of his economic advisors has had some op-ed pieces in the Wall Street Journal in the last few weeks about a topic which I feel very strongly about, and he and I disagree. So I guess that's going to start it. What is that? Okay, there's two standards that have applied for investing on Wall Street over the years, two legal standards. Some of the players on Wall Street, the players meaning the Wall Street sellers, not the investors, have been held to a standard of a fiduciary, and that is the highest standard. Is it in the client's best interest? Client's interest first, no exception. Okay, there are firms that are legally held to that standard. And that's what I think is important, because then you put your client's interest first. We don't have some of the problems I described briefly before. There's the other standard, which is it suitable for the customer? Well, that means, given the customer's resources, is this sort of an okay investment? So it's okay to put them in the Lode Mutual Fund with a 5% commission, because that's a suitable investment for him. Or it's okay to put him in a more risky bond, because maybe that's suitable, even if it's not in his best interest. Okay. The Department of Labor has come out with some proposed regulations, which are supposed to go final next April, that would apply the fiduciary standard to all pension plans. Hmm. And I think that's a great idea. There are those who say, no, if we do that, then small people aren't going to be able to get the advice they want. I don't believe that for a minute, and we can't go into the details now. I can tell you how I think we can get that handled very effectively at much lower costs. But Mr. Trump's advisor has said, if we do this, this is slavery.
This being applied, the lower standard.
If we apply the fiduciary standard to the pension funds, it's going to be slavery. And what I'm about to say, I know you're not going to believe, and I'm not making it up. He compared it to the Dred Scott decision, legalizing the return of the fugitive slaves to the South. So if this is the person he's listening to, we're not going to get very far. Mm-hmm. Clearly, any efforts to rein in a lot of the things that I think need to be fixed are going to be slowed down to a halt or not happen at all. I didn't even think if Hillary Clinton were elected, given her relationship with $250,000 an hour speeches at Goldman Sachs, we were going to get very far. But clearly, with the Republicans controlling it and Trump being the president, so I think we're going to have that going to go slower. We're going to have efforts to repeal the Dodd-Frank law, which, by the way, I'm not a big fan of Dodd-Frank. I'm not sure we should throw the entire thing out, but I don't think they're going to be too judicious about it. Mm-hmm. So my fear is this is going to result in less chance to clean things up than if Hillary Clinton had been elected. We did have the risk on the other side that we would get the Bernie Sanders wing calling the shots on that. And then my fear as a capitalist lament would be we would have gone too far. Yeah. But to some degree, Wall Street brought that on themselves. And I think that that's another way when I think that they've actually harmed America by exposing us to overregulation when as a reaction to their taking advantage of the system.
Yeah.
So I think that the election, has that aspect. The tax policies could have a big effect, and at this point, I can't tell which way that's going to go.
But the carried interest element, it seemed that Clinton and Trump, superficially at least, agreed on taxing the carried interest as ordinary income.
Well, again, just for the audience that aren't technically advised, the carried interest is the example I talked about before where you get your 20% of the profits if it goes up. Well, that 20% of the profits, I don't care what spin anybody on Wall Street puts on it, is compensation for your services in putting together the deal and choosing the investments. You have no personal capital involved for that so-called carried interest. And to tax it as capital gain, which is what happens under current law, is, in my opinion, an outrage. One of the few things that Hillary Clinton and Trump agreed on in the campaign is that that should be taxed as capital gains, not ordinary interest. Ordinary income.
Other way around.
Which would, as capital, pardon me, they agreed it should be taxed as ordinary income, not capital gains as it currently is, which would mean about a 20% higher tax. In other words, federal tax. So instead of paying 20%, they'd pay 40% in line with what every other wealthy person in America pays on earned income. So we'll see if the Republicans follow through on that, given their anti-tax increase plan. I don't know, but at least Trump himself has been in favor of it. And just maybe it'll happen, because when George Bush was president, it looked like they were going to pass that. It actually cleared the House, but it was killed in the Senate, strange but true, by Senator Schumer, liberal Democrat, but from New York.
Yeah. Ha ha. Surprise. Well, I'm going to turn now this evening over to our audience questions, because I'm sure you have a lot to ask Leland, and as a reminder, to please use a microphone. So
I want to remind our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and on the radio that we are listening to Leland Faust in conversation with Roy Eisenhart. With us on the subject today of A Capitalist Lament, How Wall Street is Fleecing You and Ruining America. Please come up to the microphone for questions.
I appreciate you telling us a lot about how we're getting ripped off by Wall Street. And what I'm wondering as an investor is how can I invest in a way where I'm not getting ripped off?
Good question.
Yeah. Well, I think there are a couple of answers to that. I mean, one is if you're doing it yourself, or a second if you're asking other people for advice. So the starting point, and I mentioned it before, if you're asking other people for advice, is, in my view, only deal with fiduciaries. Okay, how do you tell they're fiduciaries? You ask them. How do you know that that's for real? Get it in writing. And it's a simple letter. I am serving in a fiduciary capacity only, period. Signed, advisor. They won't sign it. Then you say, I'm happy to have interviewed you, and I'll find someone who is a fiduciary. So that's the first thing. The second thing, clearly, whether you're being advised by a fiduciary or you're doing it yourself, no gambling products. So you invest in stocks, you invest in bonds, you can invest in real estate directly or through real estate investment trusts. You invest in things where you actually are investing in assets. You're not investing or gambling, pardon me, against one another. So you don't do short sales, you don't do derivatives, you don't borrow money to lever up your investment. Some of the companies themselves or the real estate firms themselves have borrowing. You don't need to pile it on top so any mistake gets amplified, which is why so many of these companies went under in 2008. In some cases, they were leveraged as high as 20 or 30 to 1, which meant if the value of their investments went down by 3%, they were bankrupt. Well, that's an insanity in my view. And so you don't do that. You find the low-cost products. You find the mutual funds that have, or the exchange-traded funds that have the lowest cost fees. And you look at track records, but you look at the lowest cost. So you stay diversified. You can't be so smart. You're not, I'm not, and they aren't so smart as to know what the next great thing is. So you stay diversified throughout. Doesn't mean you never change your allocation, but you don't say, today I'm 100% in stocks and tomorrow I'm 100% in bonds. There was a wonderful illustration of that a few years ago. At that point, some of these big firms had stock funds and had bond funds. And then they came up with this idea, well, we could sell our tactical asset allocation fund. We'll own stocks or bonds, and we'll vary the percentages by what's good for the client because we can tell when the markets are going to change. Well, so a number of these firms started it. Well, after the first 3 years that I looked at them for a couple of these major, major firms. Okay, so you had, these are not the real numbers, but the stock portfolios, went up 30%. And the bond portfolios, went up 20%. And the tactical asset allocation funds went up 15%. So you'd have been better off buying either one and not touching it than having them tell you when to move in and out. So you don't want to be playing that game. So you have to be long-term, in my view, in your investments. In and out is a recipe for disaster. So you want to have high quality, again, is my opinion. Others will say, go for it. If you want to go for it, then you wouldn't be asking me for advice. So, you want to, if you adhere to these kind of principles, then I believe you can get out of all this abuse that I've been talking about, and the system works. Somebody asked me, and it wasn't just any old somebody, somebody asked me, who at the time he asked me, didn't know he was named in the book. I don't know if he does now. But he said, if everything you said is true, how can you account for the great prosperity in America and the stock market over the last 30 years? And I said, easy. I said, the free enterprise system is so strong that it's managed to overcome the abuse that's been heaped upon it. Yeah. And I still believe that. So I guess that would be what you can do, in a 3 or 4 minute dissertation. but maybe we should move on to the next question.
Yeah. Thank you. I hope that was helpful. Yeah.
Okay. Hi. What are the solutions to reigning in Wall Street? And I wonder this because an observation is that regulation doesn't seem to be able to keep up with as quickly as Wall Street moves. It just doesn't move as quickly. I worked on Wall Street for 11 years, and the business changed a lot, and the way we did business changed a lot during those 11 years.
Well, I think that's what you said is true, that the regulation has not kept up with, the creative solutions that Wall Street and their lawyers come up with. But I think it's a matter of no one's really trying and a matter of will to a large degree. I don't want to suggest it's easy. That's number one. But number two, you're fighting this incredible amount of money and power that it brings. As of a couple of months ago, so these are not the final figures, but as of a couple of months ago, of all money in America given to the presidential campaign, 14% came from hedge funds. Just hedge funds, 14%, let alone the rest of Wall Street. So, you know, there was an honest testimony given before Congress some years ago having nothing to do with Wall Street. It was about big campaign contributions. And the person was asked, said, well, you gave all this money. Did you think you were buying influence? And in a moment of honesty, the guy said, well, damn right I did. So there's that problem. There's also the problem that too much of Wall Street's regulation and enforcement has been checking boxes, not caring about what's really important, just bureaucrats doing their job, and they couldn't care less other than to complete the day. And that's a real problem. And, I mean, I even had years ago an auditor from the state of California who acknowledged that to me. And he came in for an unannounced audit, which is what happens to registered investment advisors. And in those days, no matter how big you were, you had to be registered with every state in which you operated, as well as the SEC in Washington. So he came in and he said, well, you know how this is going to go. I said, no, how's this going to go? He said, well, you know, I'm going to poke around here for a few days. And he said, I'm going to find something or two where there's a technical violation because there's so many little rules. And he said, and then I'm going to send you a letter telling you about that. And he said, and then you or your lawyer are going to send me back a letter saying, gee, we're sorry, and we're going to fix it. And that'll be the end. He said, we both know that the guys that are really cheating don't register, so I can't audit them. Yeah. And that's what's been going on. And so you get too much of that, or you get the SEC not paying any attention. And, of course, the example is the Madoff case. The Madoff, you know, right. The biggest, you know, fraud on Wall Street, it was called a hedge fund. It really wasn't. It was just a Ponzi scheme. $50 billion over years and years. Well, while that was going on, there was a guy who was operating a hedge fund, working for, you know, his boss, but he was managing a hedge fund. And his boss hauled him in one day and said, I have a problem with you. You're doing exactly what Madoff's doing, and you're not making anywhere near the money he is. How come? Well, he said, you know, gulp. So he went and he investigated. And then he wrote a letter to the SEC after he shared it with his boss, explaining, you know, what the problem was. And in case anybody didn't bother to read the text, the title of the letter was something like, I don't have the exact title here, but I'm going to get it close enough. It's why the biggest hedge fund in the world is a fraud. And they totally ignored it. And he sent something again a year or so later, and they ignored it. And then it blew up a few years later. So this is what they're not paying attention to. And what they do pay attention to are little nothing rules that don't really matter. So they go out of their way to make sure that if you work for an investment advisory firm, you don't buy 100 shares of IBM stock before your clients buy IBM stock because you might move the market. Now, there are certainly circumstances where an investment advisor could do that. He could buy first, have his clients move the market and profit, but not with 100 shares of IBM. Yeah. But you have to keep all those records if you're an investment advisor, and then they come in and inspect those records. So they're worried about that instead of what's happening with the biggest fraud in hedge funds. So,
but they did get Martha Stewart.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. They got Martha Stewart, but quite frankly, they got her because she or her lawyers gave her horrible advice. When they came in, what did she do? She lied about it. She obfuscated, so they got her for obstruction of justice. If Martha Stewart, this is just my guess, can't prove it, but when they came in, if Martha Stewart said, hey, look, guys, I sell cookbooks and decoration. How can I help you? No one would ever bother her. Why should they have?
But one thing might point out is also the SEC doesn't have jurisdiction over hedge funds. Isn't that true? I mean,
No, the SEC...
They operate out and or in a different zone?
Well, the SEC has some jurisdiction, but they don't have to register with the SEC the same way.
Yeah.
So they don't, you know, they can sell securities, the interest in the funds, without being registered. So they have much laxer rules.
Yeah.
Unlike a mutual fund, they do not have to disclose their holdings to the SEC. There are some rules that the advisor to the hedge funds have to disclose some aspects of their holdings, but not what the hedge funds themselves own. So for completeness, I'm just sort of throwing that in. But no, there's much less regulation of the hedge funds because they're supposedly being bought by well-heeled advisors, I mean, pardon me, investors who can take care of themselves. Yeah. But it's an outrage when over half of the hedge funds in the country today are held by pension funds.
Yeah.
And those are public entities, many of them, or corporate pension funds. And for hedge funds to be in there and them not being registered and regulated much more severely is a true outrage.
Mm-hmm. Hi there, Mr. Faust. My name's Chad Masipo. I'm more in the sports world, and I'm listening to your about getting involved in the hedge funds and getting involved in your own fund at all. And I'm just interested in how you got involved into the sports world, into the, like, being named Sporting News Top 100 influential people. Does that come with sports investments with your clients? Or I'm wondering how you that moved into from where you started to what you do now.
Sure. Well, I started, you know, my professional career doing tax law and a little bit of investment work for, you know, regular high net worth people, but I had always been involved in sports myself my entire life as a participant. I was a swimmer and water polo player, so not a professional, but in a fan of professional sports, and I thought that the professional athletes, as best I could tell, were being grossly underserved. So I said, maybe you can kind of combine what you do for a living with, you know, an interest that you have. So I started talking to a few people and eventually, you know, obtained a few clients who were professional athletes. And by following my kind of own advice of slow and steady, kind of gradually did things the right way and built up a practice with the professional athletes. And then by doing that, I got to know all the agents and the unions, and so it was the interactions that I had between advising players, working with the unions, working with the agents, that, you know, the Sporting News recognized me as, you know, of an interesting person in sports. But my main business in that, my only business in that, was advising the professional athletes on how to manage their money, you know, doing. Helping with their taxes, other financial issues, but I was representing the individual athletes doing that. So that's how it happened.
This is a very understated answer. One of the biggest problems in professional sports is the frequency with which players, once they retire, become financially insolvent. And I think it'd be worth you taking a little bit of time and explaining the frequency of bankruptcy, for example, in the NFL players after their retirements.
Well, right. Unfortunately, the biggest problem that most of the professional athletes face, despite all the horror stories with investments, is not the investments. It's their ability to save money and put it away. And the spending is often, you know, out of control, and it's incredible to see how someone can run through not only hundreds of thousands but millions of dollars a year, and that really was the hardest part of my work. And, you know, as good as our work was with the athletes, and, you know, we were able to shield them and our, you know, regular clients, for lack of a better term, from the turmoils of Wall Street in a real way, and you know, outperform the indexes and that kind of stuff. That's not where our biggest help to the athletes was. It was getting them to save their money, not be taken advantage of, that type of thing. I mean, I had a discussion a number of years ago, but with the person who was in charge of the National Football League's Players Association, not the league, but the Players Association. They had a voluntary registration program for financial advisors. They couldn't require them to register, but they asked them to. And then they were able to put the screws on a little bit because they control the agents by law, and they told an agent, we will not allow you to represent a player if you refer business to anybody that's not on our voluntary list. So to the extent an agent wanted to make a referral, and you had to register. But anyway, so I was talking to the guy who ran it, whom I'd known for years, and we had a very good rapport. We respected one another. And I said to him, look, I said, so much of your effort is just a waste because I said, half the league is broke. And he said, no, half the league's not broke. I said, yes, they are. They kind of, even if not technically, they're living paycheck to paycheck, so it's kind of the same thing. He said, well, I disagree with you. He said, but, he said, within 2 years of being out of the league, 70% are broke. So that's, you know, that's what he had to say. So it's a huge, huge problem. And yeah, is it getting better? Well, it's getting somewhat better as the numbers keep going up and up and the salaries keep going up and up. And yeah, it's a whole lot harder to go broke on $10 million a year than it is on $5 million a year. So as these salaries keep going up and up, then there is hope. But it's a real problem. I am on record as saying that the unions ought to all collectively bargain as part of what they do, massive deferred compensation plans. So whether you make the minimums in these leagues or whether you make $25 million a year, a certain high percentage of that gets put away in addition to their current pension plan, which doesn't kick in until they're 55 or 62. So they're covered from the time they're 30 until they get to that pension plan, and they make so much money, nobody would feel that pinch at all, and they would be able to solve that problem. But so far, I've been, you know, yelling at the, you know, at the wall.
All right, thank you.
At this point in our program, I want to suggest that we just have 2 minutes remaining, and so there's time for just one last question.
Thank you, and I appreciate the discussion. This is on a completely different thought process here. So there's tremendous leverage across the globe, across government, business, and individuals, and it's putting a lot of strain, of course, this amount of leverage. What is your professional opinion on what that's going to do to the performance of asset classes over, let's say, the next 2 to 5 years?
Well, I hesitate because that's the kind of prediction that I think is fraught with peril, and I, you know, always tell people, you know, don't be involved with those kind of predictions. I'll share with you one aspect before I attempt to just give you a little answer. Yeah, there's one thing that a massive study over 10 years by a Berkeley professor and another professor, and I forgot where they looked. They had 2,800 well-known people make predictions over 10 years on economics and politics. And their two conclusions were, well, not their only two, but their two primary conclusions were, one, that the more precise the prediction, the much less likely it was going to happen. And number two, the more prominent the predictor, the less likely it was to happen. I guess so. Since I'm not prominent, then you're in good hands. But all I would say is, from my point of view, debt is a real problem. There is, long ago, I tried to differentiate between what I thought was good debt and bad debt. Good debt was debt when people took out, or companies or governments even, for good purposes, productive purposes, with a clear path to repayment. So if you borrow money to buy a house and you can afford your mortgage, then you've got your earnings. It's a clear path to repayment over time. Great. That makes sense to do. Okay, if you're a corporation and you borrow money and you say, well, look, it's realistic that I'm going to have an income stream and I can pay this back and I don't have to spend every penny of earnings to pay it back. And that's fine. That makes a lot of sense. There's a clear path to repayment. But if there is no clear path to repayment, for instance, most credit card debt in America, you know, people can't pay this back. So that's not good debt. That's bad debt. Well, to the extent that it's much bigger, over-leveraging corporations or over-leveraging government, then I think it's a problem. And I'm fearful that it's not going to be dealt with very well, because dealing with it means you got to deal with it today and not keep pushing the can down the road. And that's been too much of that. There's been too much of that with government, and there's been too much of that on Wall Street and the corporations and the boards of directors of the corporations. Let's borrow money so we can, you know, buy back stock and lever ourselves up and make more money, and our stock options will be worth more. Never mind what's going to happen to the company in 5 or 10 years. Yeah. So I see it as a big problem. I don't have any solution, except we need to go kind of slow and steady in addressing it. And we can clearly stop the growth. That doesn't take a lot of effort. So let's at least start there and then see what we can do. But I wish I had the answer. Beyond that, I don't. And I don't think anybody really does.
At this point, I want to again thank Leland Faust in conversation with Roy Eisenhart. For today's comments, we invite you to the book signing held immediately after the program. We also want to thank our audiences here at the club, as well as our radio audience and C-SPAN. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.